Good morning, everybody, or afternoon, wherever or whenever you're listening to this. Welcome back to the Midwestern Archaeology Podcast. Today, I am thrilled to be joined by a true powerhouse in the field of archaeology, Dr. Cheryl P. Clausen. Dr. Clausen earned her PhD from Harvard University in 1982 after completing her undergraduate studies at the University of Arkansas. Over the decades, she's made a lasting impact on the field through her groundbreaking work in North American archaeology, symbolism, gender studies, and the sociology of archaeology. Her research delves deep into topics like shell artifacts, cave use, archaic period societies, with a strong focus on the Eastern United States and Mexico. She also has a forthcoming book titled Women, Fertility, and North American Archaeology. It is a collection of published essays on gender and ancient Eastern North American archaeology. She is also the recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Southeastern Archaeological Conference. So thank you so much, Dr. Clausen, for being here today.
Sure.
Awesome. So let's just dive into it. So I'm really curious about your professional journey. So what was your initial interest in archaeology, and when did you start to think that you could do this as a career?
My parents used to drop me off for Sunday school. And in fourth grade, I started walking on through the church, skipping the Sunday school room and going back to the library. And there was a book called Oscar Og and the 26 Letters. And I picked, it was a picture book, but it was also had text in it. And it was the story of the development of the 26 letters in the Roman alphabet. In the Latin alphabet. And it had a lot of, you know, information in there about excavation in the Holy Land and all of that. And that was my first brush with archaeology, so that's what I wanted to do. And so I announced in fourth grade that I was going to be a Near Eastern archaeologist. I didn't use those terms.
Okay.
But
there
biblical,
you go. Yeah.
A biblical archaeologist.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
And I started excavating locally. I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So I started excavating locally with the Gilcrease Museum in ninth grade, and started volunteering at the Gilcrease Museum weekends in 10th grade, and probably had participated in maybe 10 excavations before I went to college in anthropology, which is how you get a degree, how you specialize in archaeology in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a straight and narrow line since fourth grade.
That's awesome. That's so cool. Was there something about the study of peoples from the past that captured your imagination? What was specifically the appeal for you when you were kind of thinking about what archaeologists do? Because I would imagine for a lot of people, you know, they get exposed to a movie like Indiana Jones and they think it's just one big adventure, you know, going to foreign countries and getting a bunch of cool artifacts.
I think my attraction was mostly the science of it, you know, the intellectuality of it, the puzzles, to work out the puzzles. So, but even though I was, you know, enrolled in a undergraduate program in archaeology at the University of Arkansas, which at the time in 1971 was the premier archaeology program in the United States because it was the start of environmental impact statements and contract archaeology. And it started right there in Fayetteville, Arkansas. And so the whole place was a buzz. So I could sort of immediately see a way to do excavating and getting paid to excavate and doing lab work and getting paid to do lab work. So it was all just very coincidence, you know, dumb luck is what it was.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when you were in your undergrad program, had you changed your scope from wanting to be a biblical kind of Near Eastern archaeologist?
Sure.
Were you thinking more, maybe more American,
yes.
Ancient American?
Well, I mean, I like so many things. You get turned on by what you're doing. And so when I started excavating in ninth grade, I was doing local northeastern Oklahoma archaeology. So I thought, okay, I want to be a historic archaeologist. When I went to college, there weren't any historical archaeology programs, but there I had worked in a rock shelter and at a prehistoric site. And so the University of Arkansas's archaeology program was entirely what we used to call prehistoric archaeology, pre-contact archaeology. And so, you know, immediately I'm funneled into doing pre-contact and, you know, kind of forget about the historic, forget about the Near Eastern, and just do what's at hand. Always, I mean, it's always puzzle working. So it didn't matter in my freshman year in college anyway. It didn't matter where I was getting challenged with puzzles.
That's awesome. So you've also done a lot of writing about women's experience in the field of archaeology. And I'm curious, did you experience any kind of resistance or pushback when you were initially getting into the field?
No. The University of Arkansas, again, was a very unique situation. In the 1970s. And two people basically brought about the existence of contract archaeology, and one of them was a woman and one of them was a man. And the woman was Hester Davis. She herself had experienced some difficulty. She ended up having to cook on excavation crews rather than getting to dig.
Wow.
But so she was the state archaeologist in Arkansas, and just as a matter of just kind of, again, luck, the Arkansas Archaeological Survey had five research stations around the state. Three of them were filled with women who had gotten PhDs, Ann Early and Martha Rawlingson, and well, I guess two of them were filled. And so the graduate program, I was in the undergraduate program, but the graduate program had more women in seeking master's degrees in archaeology than men. So the scholarships were going to women, getting hired was going to women. We had strong women representatives of archaeologists all around us. I went to the summer after my senior year, I went to field school at a site that the University of Arizona was running called Grasshopper Ruin. And now there, things were very different. And it had two men running the project, one of whom was quite nice and the other one who was a total jerk. And he would sit around reading Playboy in the morning, and we'd go into breakfast. It was a cabin, bunkhouse, kitchen, very rustic setting. And he would be reading Playboy in the morning when the women would come in, and he'd flip pictures around and say, you know, who in here looks like this? And I mean, that was pretty disgusting.
That's horrifying.
And then I went to graduate school at Harvard. I was the 17th woman to enter the program at Harvard. And I only knew the names of two of the women, two of my predecessors. The others, you know, I don't know what happened to them. But one of the major professors, Stephen Williams, a North American archaeologist, would stand up in his intro to archaeology courses and tell freshman classes that no woman had ever made a significant contribution to archaeology.
Wow.
So, you know, that I wasn't subjected to that because I was a graduate student, but I taught undergraduates at their sophomore and their junior tutorial levels, and I would hear from them. So here I am. I was the only graduate student woman in my class cohort. So, you know, they're hearing that no woman's made a significant contribution, and they're seeing only one woman on the faculty at Harvard, Ruth Tringham, who I aligned with as my mentor and advisor. And, you know, we heard stuff constantly. So it was very, Arkansas was a really unique and wonderful place to be in the 70s.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, you'd think of all places, Harvard University would be an inclusive space, but I guess not in the 70s.
No.
Curious about the stories buried beneath your feet? The Archaeological Research Institute, ARI, is your gateway to exploring the past right here in the Ohio River Valley. From hands-on digs to immersive exhibits and cutting-edge research, we make archaeology real. Discover the power of the past. Visit exploreari.org and start your journey today.
I read your paper, Homophobia and Archaeology, and thought it was really good, very illuminating. And in that paper, you kind of talk about how archaeology traditionally, well, seen as like a more masculine thing. So getting down and dirty, these are, you know, excavating are things that are thought to be assigned to men, and that's kind of what prevented a lot of women from pursuing like a postdoctorate or just a higher like graduate degree or something like that.
I make the point in that article that there was as late as 1960, there were medical textbooks saying that women who engaged in strenuous physical activity, their genitalia would change and they would become men.
Yes. They would lose
fertility. But you know, so I argue in that article that in the turn of the century that, you know, that was definitely playing a part in discouraging women and their parents from letting them go into geology, archaeology, any of the fields where, you know, you're doing a lot of physical labor.
Field work. Yeah. And as time went on, how do you feel that archaeology has changed since that time in the 70s in terms of acceptance of feminist and queer voices and perspectives in archaeology?
It's changed a lot, but you have to understand that the archaeologists have changed. So, I mean, if you took queer and women and surrounded us with everybody who was an archaeologist in the 1970s and the 1980s, I don't know how much it would change. But now you've got a lot of 30-somethings and 40-somethings and 50-somethings who are much more open, much more inclusive, much more out in their various proclivities about all kinds of things. And as they come to form the largest cohort, their values, which are much more inclusive and accepting, are overriding the older cohort's values. So archaeology has changed a lot. I wouldn't say that if you put all those 50 and 60 and 70-year-old archaeologists in the 1940s and 50s and 60s in the modern setting, that they would be very happy.
Well, it's not, I would imagine that it's not just affecting maybe the culture of this age cohort, as you were saying, not just the culture amongst themselves, but the research that they're doing as well. I would imagine they might interpret different archaeological findings without that kind of heteronormative bias that a lot of these archaeologists that you're talking about from these earlier times might kind of view fits what they're finding into that kind of heteronormative Western way of understanding gender and sexuality. I would imagine there's a lot of research that kind of pulls that bias out of it.
And another thing that's happening is that queer has been embraced in its fullest meaning, which is on the margins or outside the norm. And so queer archaeology has probably fewer, there are probably fewer examples of trying to look at sexuality than there are examples of looking at things that those of us trained in the 70s and 80s would never consider archaeological material. And so it's queer in that sense, like doing an excavation at a peace sit-in in England, or doing an excavation of a tenement house where you're walking into the rooms and marking where all the artifacts are and you know, collecting data and entering it on your data sheets, even gritting out the floor of a house that somebody lived in 2 weeks ago. I mean, that's queer in the way that a lot of my younger colleagues are working with that concept now, is to do something that's just weird or outside the norm, and using archaeological reasoning and techniques to try to derive some meaning out of these unusual, atypical archaeological situations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think something that has really jumped out at me as I've read your articles and publications is kind of, there was one, I apologize, I can't remember the name of it right now, but it was about normative thinking or normative understanding.
Normative thinking and shell bearing sites.
Yes, that's exactly right. And how there's more to these people's lives than just the everyday, like, most simplest explanation, because there's a quote actually that I wrote down of yours. Clearly, people who lived in villages, built mounds, and feasted had more things to think about than simply eating. And that kind of understanding and trying to understand like the ontology of these people's worlds is so more, it's really interesting and fascinating, and it's engaging to read as someone who is not as versed in the archaic, to learn a little bit, maybe an interpretation about these people's intellectual lives, domestic lives. It's hard to piece together, I would imagine, given the evidence, but it's still really important and interesting work, in my opinion.
Oh, thank you.
So I guess with that being said, I guess we could turn to the time period that we've been referring to that you've spent a lot of time researching, the Archaic. So before I get into the ask you some questions about the nitty gritty, can you tell me a little bit of how you got interested in this time period and what are some of the things that you find the most interesting, I guess, about this time period?
We're talking about 10,000 to 3,000 years ago. And in the eastern U.S., mm-hmm. Now the Archaic has different time parameters in other parts of the United States. Mm-hmm. But in the eastern U.S., 10,000 to 3,000 years ago, and I'm most interested in the 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 year period. How I got interested is I had, as an undergraduate, I'd been exposed to the archaeology of Kentucky and Tennessee and whatever, and it. And this, mm-hmm. the Archaic period in the 1970s, when I was an undergrad, was about as boring as you could get. All people did was scrabble around for food. And, and you know, beyond that, there wasn't anything that you could say about them. So I developed a technique for determining when in a year shellfish had been harvested. I can't tell you what year, but I could tell you what month. And that's based on growth line information. So I was invited to come, and that I had developed it on marine shell. And Patty Jo Watson, who was a very well-versed and very well-respected archaeologist who recently died, was working on some sites in the Green River in Kentucky. And she asked me to come try out my technique on these freshwater shells. And so I'm in a looter's pit that's about 7 feet deep, and face to face with the strata of shell and dirt and rock. And I was really impressed by the size of them. I was really impressed by learning that this phenomenon of mounding shell, freshwater shell, stopped seemingly abruptly, and that a lot of the shells that I was looking at in this column of the site that I was looking at, the Deweese site, a lot of the shells were still paired. And I'm, you know, that's just raised 99 questions. I mean, why are they paired? They're calling these village sites. How do you walk around on shells and not break them apart? Why do you collect them if you're not going to break them apart? Why did it stop so abruptly? So I'd have to say that as I was finishing up my graduate work and thinking about what I had read about the Archaic and even thinking about what I'd read about the sites on the Green River, it was just a really, you know, it was another very intriguing puzzle that I thought maybe I could bring to bear some interesting perspectives on from the shellfish angle. So that's how I got launched into this. And that was probably 1980 or 1981. I finished a dissertation in 82, but that was also a dissertation on shell, on marine shell. So, and at the same time, I was in Boston and a friend brought me a freshwater shell that had a bunch of nicely cut out round holes on it. And I said, what is this? And I started researching. It turned out there'd been a shell button cutting factory outside of Boston. Whoa. And that this was a shell that it had shell buttons cut out of it, and launched me into the whole shell button industry. So I felt like my research was the Archaic shell use, and my hobby now was the freshwater shell button industry.
That's really cool. That's really cool. Yeah, I have a lot of so I've been telling a lot of my coworkers that I was going to interview you, and I familiarized, some of them had heard of you and some of them I familiarized them, and they were really interested in the freshwater mussels. So my next question deals with the Ohio River and other riverine ecosystems, such as the Green River of the lower Midwest. So obviously these ecosystems have changed a lot since the Archaic. What were the rivers of the Archaic like, and how are they different to today's rivers? So obviously a lot of changes have happened, most especially from what I understand, a lot of biodiversity lost. But I'm just curious if you can give us a window or a glimpse into maybe what it was like for these Archaic humans to be living on the banks of these rivers.
The freshwater shellfish contain the different species, and there are hundreds of species of them, contain or provide interesting information about the environment they're growing in. So some species like muddy, deep bottoms. Some species like Riffle Run. Some species like highly oxygenated water, meaning lots of water movement. Some species prefer, or can tolerate mud when other species can't. So we can do some river construction by going through and listing the species and particularly working out the proportions of all the different species to each other. And so you can say, well, this site was located beside a riffle run, or this site was located in a meander scar or a meander curve. So, I mean, different sections of the river will show, you know, different kinds of bottoms and different oxygen levels. And so, I mean, the only blanket statement I could make about how the rivers are different is that there's a whole lot more siltation now because of agriculture and construction. So the silt loads have gotten much, much heavier. And of course, it's going to change the molluscan fauna in the river so that species that can tolerate silt become the largest proportion of species that are in the river. So the other thing that happens is in pounding in historic times. So you get dams that are backing up the river. So again, where there might have been riffle runs, now there's deep water, slow deep water. And again, the species are going to change. So we can talk about those changes. These sites on the Green River, curiously, don't reflect overwhelmingly riffle run. They reflect more deeper water and slower water. There are some other sites that show more riffle run. So, but one of the interesting things to me is that the oldest site on the Green River is not on the Green River. It's on a tributary of the Green. And furthermore, the shells are at the top of a bluff. So tributaries are not particularly rich in molluscan population, certainly not as rich as the Green River itself would have been. So why is it then that this shell fishing begins on a tributary and not in the main river? And why is it that the shellfish, that these shells are hauled to the top of, they're hauled 120 feet above the river to be accumulated on the top of a bluff along with human burials. So, yeah. So,
interesting.
There is some interesting, some really interesting stuff about what the motivations are. Again, suggesting it's not food. Or if it is food, there's some overriding situation that wants them to kind of hide their existence or their presence there.
What's the name?
Well,
of
there
that
are several
site?
Bluff top sites on this oldest site is called Ward. The Ward site, W-A-R-D.
Warden.
And then there's several other bluff type sites on the Green proper, like Baker.
So the next couple questions really deal with the freshwater mussels and the archaic humans' relationship to them. So I guess I'm curious about the humans that were around at that time, their relationship to these mussels. Were different species used for different things? Or so you mentioned that not all of them were utilized just for food. Were there certain kinds of mussels that were used for maybe decorative purposes or other kinds of things, and their uses might have told us about their lifestyles or something like that?
No, there are no species specific uses except for a gastropod, a freshwater gastropod called Leptoxys. And Leptoxys used to be called Ankylosa, the genus. And Leptoxys shows up in sites along with all the other bivalve mollusks, but it also was used from Texas through Alabama on up into Kentucky. It was used as beads, shell beads, and the top little spire was ground off, and then they'd thread something through the aperture and out the spire to wear it. And their anklets, their bracelets, their necklaces, and there are several burials where it's clear from the distribution of the Leptoxys that they were sewn onto a fabric. They're in rows. The fabric's long gone, but the beads are still laid out in parallel horizontal rows. So that's the only unique use for any of these things. You get to marine shell, there, that's a different story. Florida, you know, they use one species for chisels and another species for hammers, and But with these freshwater shells, they're all piled up. They were all, I think they were pretty much all used as food and as building material, construction material.
Like grit or something, like pounding it up and then mixing it in with something?
You mean for construction? No, just the bulk of the shell makes the bauxite.
Oh, wow.
So it's just tossing whole valves. You know, you talk about bivalves, so you've got a valve on each side. You just toss the whole valve into the accumulating pile. But I hope we get to the point that I do not think that these are garbage piles, that these are, in fact, burial contexts, intentionally created burial contexts.
So I've heard about shell middens for a while now, but when I started realizing that there were human burials that were sometimes in these middens, it's really fascinating. And I think what's really interesting about these shell middens is that they kind of come at what seems to be an important time, at least in this area, at this time and place. So something that I read in one of your articles was that there seems to be some experiments with sedentism during this time, where people maybe at least for part of the year, or maybe a majority of the year, were kind of fixed in one location, if not the whole year. And given that sedentism kind of has this connotation or association with agricultural societies, how were these archaic people groups able to remain fixed in one location for most of the year? Is it because of their access to these freshwater mollusks? And because if so, that's just really interesting. From what I understand, it's really hard to just remain in one area without being a farmer full time or cultivating crops.
There is no evidence that there's any horticulture or gardening. I don't think these are villages. I don't think these are long-term residents. I think what they're doing, that I think these are ceremonial centers, and people come together for, you know, could be 6 weeks, could be 8 weeks. They start to gather, host guest situations. So this year's ceremony might be at the Reed site. They're the hosts, and they've invited you to come. And then the next year's ceremony is at Indian Knoll, and you've got somebody that. But people aren't necessarily living there very long. They may be there 6 to 8 weeks to set things up and prepare, you know, gather the offerings that are going to happen for the ceremonies, to prepare, you know, whatever has to be prepared. So this is the main problem that I've had with my colleagues in the who are interested in the archaic, and even those who aren't interested in the archaic get stuck on this, is the degree to which these are villages. And colleagues who are working with shell rings and shell heaps on the coast of Florida and South Carolina and Georgia have pretty convincingly, you know, they've all convinced each other that those sites are ceremonial. Several of them seem to have started out as villages, but then fairly quickly were repurposed as ceremonial centers. Or for some of the others, that they're year-round habitation, but with a very low population that swells during during ceremonies. And so those ceremonies are moving around the landscape over a decadal cycle. So there's a group of people who claim a ceremonial center, even if they're not living there full time. They're the host for a ceremony. Right. They set everything up. They send out the invitations, and the guests show up, and everybody has a good time for 6 weeks hanging out at Indian Knoll, or hanging out at Reed or Ward or Eva or Anderson site, some very large sites or the Perry site, Mulberry Creek in Alabama. These are some huge sites. And some of these shell collections, shell heaps are small, and some of these shell heaps are huge. And I think that the size of them reflects how many times they hosted one of these ceremonies.
Oh, interesting. So these congregation events probably would have happened during the warmer months, possibly, maybe sometime in the fall. And then for the rest of the year, they would have been dispersed about the landscape. Kind of hunting, gathering, the kind of lifestyle that we might imagine.
I did work out my month of death technique on the freshwater shells from the Deweese site. And what I found there was that there was evidence of May through October harvesting. So, you know, some of it is probably daily food. The bulk of it, I think, is feasting food. So you're right. And it's probably somewhere late summer or very early fall, maybe August, September, October, when these ceremonies are scheduled, I think.
Okay. So even if it is maybe not necessarily these huge feasts are happening, they're only happening maybe during a set period, a set season of the year. It's clear that, or at least to me, that these eating mollusks and, you know, kind of throwing them in these mounds was an important part, or it was a kind of an important part of these people's lives and maybe their societies. There was a label that you gave these people that kind of, or a way to describe their subsistence strategy as hunter-gatherer shellfishers. Basically, which is really interesting. I haven't heard that label or phrase before, and I'm just curious, do you think that these people were fixed on these kind of riverine networks, or like, did they just kind of live and operate in those areas, or was shellfishing and mollusk eating, was that just something they did during a certain period of the year?
I think that every shell mound has a social group tethered to it. Now, all of the shell mounds didn't exist simultaneously. And our radiocarbon dating, or dating of any kind of these sites, is horrible. We have very few dates from very few sites. I mean, we're talking 60 sites on the Tennessee River, and we probably have radiocarbon dates on 12 of them, and one or two or three. There are some sites on the Tennessee, like Eva and Cherry and Ledbetter Landing now, that have a lot more due to Thad Bissett's work in that area. We know, you know, our ability to talk about how many of these places there were, some of them started 8,500 years ago, and some of them are starting at 3,000 years ago. Some of them finish at 7,000 years ago, and some of them are abandoned at 4,000 years ago, and some of them are abandoned at 2,000 years ago. So they're not all operating simultaneously, so it's kind of hard to talk about. But I think the ones that are, I think that each one of them has a social network tethered to it. Now, whether it's five generations of the same social network, and that it just maybe moved a little bit along the river here or there, I don't know. It would be nice if we could do the radiocarbon dating. Curiously, the two most obvious activities at these shell heaps are shell gathering, which we have eight radiocarbon dates on, and burial. And we have about 21 radiocarbon dates on burial. So we don't even really know when the shellfishing started. And we have a poor understanding of when the shellfishing ended. There are radiocarbon dates on deer bone and charcoal and things like that. But a radiocarbon date on charcoal tells you about when one fire burned within a plus or minus 100 year period. So the two most obvious activities are horribly dated.
Is there a reason for that?
Well,
for that
there's this understanding that freshwater shell is a horrible medium because where do the shellfish get the calcium from to make their shells? They get it from karst. They get it from limestone cliffs. So they get it. Their shell is made up of old carbon. But there have been advances along those lines where you can actually pick out the organic part of a mollusk and shell and radiocarbon date the organics in it. But people haven't, that hasn't been anybody else's interest.
So you've alluded to the burials that are found at these midden sites, and I'm really interested in those. I read your paper on infanticide, and I'm curious what the burials, obviously there's a lot of them and they're variable, but how do these burials at these midden sites offer us glimpses into what was these people's lives, basically? So how can we get that information, not just because the shell middens are fascinating in their own right, but the fact that they were burying humans, they're dead there as well, kind of says something about these people. And I'm curious, what does that tell you about these people?
I started by looking at the burials, and over 20 years of looking at the burials, several things began to stand out. One is that in many of these sites, I'm talking Tennessee, Alabama, Kentucky, and Central Tennessee, not just the Tennessee River, but on the Harpeth and the Duck River too, the deepest burial is often the richest in grave goods. So I started thinking, okay, do we have consecrating burials going on? So here we're going to start putting our dead, and we need to consecrate this area. So that was one thing that was interesting to me. Another thing that was interesting to me is that because archaic people were assumed to be so simple, when the WPA folks excavated these sites in the 30s and 40s, when a body part was missing, the explanation was somebody had dug through it to put another burial in. Every now and then, they would find embedded stone projectile points or embedded antler projectile points in the bodies, and they'd say, oh, this person got killed. But that was...
History isn't just in the books. It's in the soil, the stones, and the stories of your region. Join ARI's regional archaeological tours and explore hidden sites, historic landscapes, and the places where history happened, led by real archaeologists filled with real discoveries. See the land like you've never seen it before. Check out our tour dates at exploreari.org.
That was that. I began to look at all the different burial postures. At the same time, several other people, because of the Native American Grave Protection and Repatriation Act inventories of skeletal collections in museums, at the same time they were doing their aging and sexing and all of this, they come up with scalped individuals, people who've had their lower arms severed. You can see the cut marks at their elbows. People who are headless, and you can see the cut marks at the neck. So all of a sudden, you know, we're working simultaneously. I'm looking at burial positions and overlaying some of this trauma data. And I realize that there's a high proportion of people in the bigger sites that appear to have been murdered. So one of the, there a couple of characteristics of this, they're often included in multiple graves, in a grave with multiple bodies. And you know, might find a grave with five bodies in it, and at least one person in there has evidence of a violent death. They're extended. Their bodies are extended when the dominant way of burial in the Southern Ohio Valley in the Archaic is in tightly flexed, knees up to the chest, or loosely flexed, but one version or another of flexed. Extended burials have a very high proportion of violent traumas. So I'm going, okay, let me go back through these graves in these sites and look at just how many people are extended, how many are flexed, how many have embedded points, how many are headless, how many separate heads are found. And every now and then, they'll also find like a pair of lower legs. And I've got some statistics here. I came up with anywhere from 22 to 100% of the burials in a site either have a burial posture or direct evidence of a violent death. So then I'm thinking, okay, who's buried in these villages? Now, if these are villages, you would expect to have what anthropologists would call a normal death distribution. You would expect a lot of infants, fewer teenagers, fewer prime of life adults, and more elderly. That's not the characteristic of the deaths of the ages, these populations. In fact, if you look at Indian Knoll, which has 1,100 burials in it, it was occupied from very poorly radiocarbon dated evidence. The burial activity went on for 1,946 years. And you divide 11,000 burials into 1,946 years, and you get two burials a year in 1,100 people. Two burials a year.
Wow.
So this is not, this does, this, there are many ways in which this is not reflecting what you expect of a village death, of a death profile of a village activity. And so then I started looking at what could explain these group burials of four and five people. And some of these burials have tremendous numbers of shell beads with them, Leptoxys shell beads, but they also have marine shell beads with them too. They In the Green River, they have some of the stone beads, and they have coal. They have cannel coal beads. And I started looking at these, and to just jump ahead here, what I think is going on is that they're operating in the archaic that spans, it has members from the Falls of the Ohio all the way over to the St. John's River in Florida. It has some outlying sites, the Lamoka Lake and Frontenac in New York State. And there's even a site in Maine that looks almost identical to Indian Knoll in terms of the kinds of artifacts and the kinds of burials and the kinds of grave goods that are there. And I think this cult then had a couple of rites, rituals, that are enacted in these ceremonial gatherings at these, at all of these sites. But my focus is not the Florida sites. Several people have actually taken my ideas and applied them to some of the St. John's River freshwater shell mound burial mortuaries. They're seeing the same thing that I'm seeing. And I think this cult is what I'm calling the old fire gods cult. And a very quick story here. This comes out of the Aztecs in central Mexico who celebrated the old fire gods. But one of them was the god of the old fire from the masculine side was the stars. And the old fire from the feminine side was the hearth. And these two, the old fire masculine god, actually created a bonfire in which all the spirits came together and the new fire was born, which is the sun. And at that time, the gods had to, because the sun appeared in the sky and wouldn't move, so everybody was burning up. Rain was created at this moment to try to cool things down, but that didn't work. All the gods were sacrificed in order to get the sun to move. And then the two old fire gods birthed 400 children, and they were charged with killing their 400 children to feed human blood to the sun, to the new fire, every morning. And the Aztec rituals to honor the old, the masculine old fire god and the feminine old fire god involved the sacrifice of four humans and a fifth one either as the god itself or as a deer impersonator of the gods. So four burials, sacrifices of four and five. And that's what we're getting in these group burials. And some of these group burials, some of them go up to seven and eight. But there, I've got pages. I've got 64 documented foursomes and fivesomes in these shell mound sites. And I think there is this rich being enacted. Now, shell is a fertility and a purification symbol. And it's also in several cultures, shells are stars. So the night sky is viewed as the underworld, this under the water, the underworld rotated into the upper world position. So shells are stars. And I think burial then in these shell mounds is burial in a purification setting to send the souls of the selected people who are buried in these sites, because there are shell-free mortuaries. The ones that are carried, blessed position, that are carried to these shell heaps and then buried in these shell heaps, I think their souls are being guided into the Milky Way and the night sky. They are the new feeders of the new fire. They're also the intermediary for the living with the spirits of rain and fertility and celestial water and terrestrial water and things like that.
So what you were just talking about is super fascinating. So that there's a set of religious practices or beliefs, rituals that kind of span the Eastern America and possibly has some connection to
Mesoamerican. Well, no, I would say it goes the other way. Mesoamerican cosmology. They're hunter-gatherers. I mean, they're not doing anything nearly as sophisticated. Mesoamerica doesn't come alive until 3,500 years ago. So we're talking 7,000, 6,000 years ago. One of the things that I've long argued is that shellfish, and from my from my hobby of the shell button industry, which I did do a book on, there are over 100 rivers that the shell button industry muscled in. Tons, year after year after year of shellfish coming out of these rivers. None of the most productive rivers for the shell button industry have any of these archaic sites on them. There are very few rivers where these kinds of sites are located. And in every instance of a site that's founded before 4,000 years ago, so from 8,000 to 4,000 years ago, in every instance, the river chosen flows either west or south. I mean, west or north. And today, the most typical direction for the afterlife in Eastern North American, Native American groups is either west or north. Or up. And there are none of these sites on an east flowing section of a river. There are none of these sites before 4,000 years ago that are on a south flowing section of river. And those are, though east is always the land of birth, the direction of birth. So the fact that they, you know, that they didn't put bodies in a site on the eastern flowing section of river, at least not in the shell, that wasn't the path into the stars. It had to be a western direction or a northern direction. I think the rivers themselves are viewed as the Milky Way, and the sites are sort of constellations or stars within the Milky Way. Now, infant sacrifice seems to be going on. The best evidence of it is at Indian Knoll, and there are a number of babies that are completely enshrouded like a rebozo or a scarf in Leptoxus shell beads. Mm-hmm. And so these had obviously been sewn on to completely covering a fabric that was then wrapped around the infant. No evidence of violent death on these children, but the association with the old fire god, the masculine old fire god, is always depicted with shell beads. A shell bead collar or a shell bead cape. The tears of babies in the 15th century in Mexico were said to bring rain. So the sacrifice of children and babies could be about rain calling. And again, the creation of the new fire, the birth of the sun, is the moment at which rain was invented, according to the Aztecs. So I think this is an 8,000 year, 9,000 year story, charter story that has been milling around in the central United States and the United States. So it's very old. There's another example of one of these sites in Texas, in East Texas, Buckeye Knoll. And there are individuals there who are in these shell bead shrouds, and the bodies are on a knoll.
Wow.
There are lots of dog burials in the Tennessee and the Green River. 94% of all archaic dog burials are found in these shell sites. And dogs are historically today leaders of the dead into the Milky Way. And I think that's exactly what they were used for 8,000, 7,000, 6,000 years ago. There are two sites in particular that have 34% of all the dogs known in the archaic. One of them's the Perry site on the Alabama, on the Tennessee River in northern Alabama. The other is the Reed site, which is on the Green River. And they have 34% of 447 archaic dog burials. The dog burials are rarely with humans. The dog burials are by themselves. These are not pets. And, you know, that's one of the things that showed up in one of my undergraduate textbooks was the dog burials, the people burying their pets in their village debris.
Interesting. Yeah, we have a local site that my organization kind of stewards called the Guard Archaeological Preserve, and it dates to late pre-contact, so like a thousand years ago. And their dog burials are very, sometimes they're buried with humans, and it seems like they were treated with a lot of respect. But obviously, you know, humans' relationships with dogs especially obviously has changed quite a bit throughout the millennia since this time. I did have a question about where in the archaic we're talking. So a few episodes ago on the show, I and my coworker Amanda did one kind of on a very general overview of the Archaic. So just kind of very general stuff about the time period. And the three sub periods of the Archaic were, because the Archaic is the longest period of the four periods in Native American pre-contact history. And I'm just middle curious archaic. Where in those, so the early, middle, and late Archaic, when with middle Archaic. Oh, okay. That's where we are. Gotcha. And of those three periods, something that was really interesting to me and my co-host Amanda was the drop in sites during the middle Archaic in terms of, so we saw at least in Ohio and Indiana, there was a map that showed early Archaic sites. It was about, I'm not even going to ballpark. There was a X amount. And then the middle Archaic, there was significantly less. And then in the late, there was kind of like a rebound. And I'm just curious if that was something that you've encountered in your research this time period. And if so, if there's some sort of explanation for that, we were hard pressed to find someone kind of explaining that.
If one were to end the middle Archaic at 4,000 years ago, a lot of these shell sites stop. And it could be that these large aggregation centers meant that people were spending the rest of the year in more ephemeral sites that are harder to find, and that as this cult seems to have come to an end, there's not, you know, the magnet goes away, and so people are then spreading themselves out and doing their own so they're becoming unhinged. The other thing is the paleo could well be leading us astray in terms of trying to date sites. I mean, every year we know a little bit more about projectile point sequences and things like that, but the idea that as soon as you come up with a new point, you're abandoning the old points, and it could be the projectile point sequences. But again, the Archaic period is terribly, terribly dated. We are definitely
terribly dated. And also it seems like in the grand scheme of, you know, pre-contact archaeology, it does seem like it's a little bit less researched than the other time periods, at least in our neck of the woods, because the paleo period, people are really interested in the Clovis and the Pleistocene animals. And then in the woodland period, you have the Hopewell. And then post-contact, you've got Cahokia, or not post-contact, late pre-contact, excuse me. You have Cahokia and Fort Ancient and agricultural societies. And the Archaic seems kind of like a middle child in terms of just research being done, which is why I was drawn to your work, because it was really cool. Like, it was such an interesting glimpse into this time period that I feel like not a lot of people know that much about. So, yeah.
You brought up the topic of sacred landscape and landscape. So trying to figure out why these shell heaps are where they are is what got me into landscape. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's no coincidence that Mammoth Cave is upriver on the Green. I think it's no coincidence that Cheekbin Cave is upriver on the Harpeth. And there are two 8,000 to 7,000-year-old gastropod shell mounds on the Harpeth with some burials in them. So I started looking at caves and then thinking about these rock shelters that are around, and rock art and bluff top sites and riverside sites and shell-free mortuaries and shell mortuaries, and thinking, I bet these are all connected. They have their purposes. And maybe we're talking about a ritual calendar, a calendar round. And I, you know, another interesting thing about, say, Indian Knoll and Sugarville and Carlston Annis, those heaps on the Green River, is that a lot of the skeletons have audioexostoses, things that are generally attributed to swimmer's ear, very cold water. And I started thinking, and I even wrote a little bit about, was there a riverkeeper cult that was situated in some of these caves, like Mammoth Cave, where you'd go in and you might clean the river, or you might, I mean, it's riverine cave water is considered the purest water of all by many Native American groups. And so were they, you know, was there a riverkeeper group? Was that a cult? Was that a rite? Nobody's ever successfully explained the ear trauma with a high proportion of the skeletons in these sites.
Yeah, that's a really interesting pattern. So at these caves and rock shelters, what kind of material are these people leaving at these sites? Kind of things that you might expect at a more inhabited site or like a more ritual. Site where there you might find
they're
things
ritual,
you would associate
but, you know, again,
with
I
some
have,
sort of cult practice.
I have a generation of colleagues who created the idea that rock shelters and caves were all about poor brown people. You know, it's where you live because you didn't have any other house, or gee, isn't this convenient? We'll just hang out here and walk stooped over for the next 3 months. Or no, there's lots of ritual evidence in in the caves. Mammoth Salts Cave, for instance, the vestibule has thousands of cremated fauna and human bone pieces in there. And as you go, I mean, I've done quite a bit of work on rock shelters in Western Kentucky and Eastern Kentucky and rock shelters in Western North Carolina, and pinpointing what the ritual evidence is. Mm-hmm. But things like altars and small square post hole structures that are probably sweat lodges, and medicinal plants, baby cradles, quids, which are mashed up vegetative matter. They're probably diapers or menstrual pads, or so. And there's rock art, and there's bedrock mortars. There's lots to indicate that a number of these rock shelters were occupied by women. Parties of women, or maybe even sick women, birthing shelters, menstrual retreat locations, women's medicine societies, meeting areas, girls' initiation areas. Mammoth Cave has been suggested as a boys' initiation, dark zone. And there's lots of evidence for pits that have fauna in them from all the strata. So there'll be eagle bone, deer bone, turtle shell, aquatic turtle, you know, things that look like they're world renewal offerings. There's a rock shelter in Menifee County in Kentucky, where the excavators got down to the bottom of the shelter, and there was a big slab of bedrock, and on it side by side were 8 turkey skeletons. So, you know, so much of this, you can take exactly the same data and read it differently.
Yeah, absolutely. You alluded to difference in gender, that kind of leads me to one of the questions that I had about Indian Knoll. So you, in your research, you found a striking difference in how men and women were buried with beads in different strata. What does that tell you about the shifting social roles over time?
I don't know. That's still something that I puzzle over. I mean, it could be that there's a shift in the meaning of shell or in the meaning of shell necklaces. I don't know what it means. The other thing here is that sexing skeletons, I mean, these at Indian Knoll, you've got 4 different people who have sexed skeletons. And one of them was in the 1930s, and 2 of them were in the 1970s. And then you've got a recent one in the 1990s. The criteria for male and female has changed. So I mean, one sort of default answer to your question is that, you know, there could be something going on with the sexing that would make this less dichotomous.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess just to kind of ask another question, because you have written a lot about gender during this time period, and I do want to touch on that just a little bit because I think it's really interesting. So just a broad question that doesn't really relate to maybe specific sites, but just in your findings, what are the gender roles that you can tease out of the material evidence that you've been looking at of the archaic societies during this time? What is that process like of trying to figure out maybe the different roles that
That's
men
clearest,
and women played?
For me, it's been clearest in the rock shelter work. So in Menifee and Lee and Wolf County, Eastern Kentucky, there are a number of rock shelters that appear to be women's shelters. And what they're doing in those, I think they're menstrual retreats and birthing retreats. What they appear to be doing while they're retreating in those 3 counties is doing a lot of fiber processing. So they're stripping bark, they're creating string, they're creating rope, They're weaving bark into sections of fiber. They're a lot of string production. Now, there's some rock shelters on the Cumberland in eastern Tennessee where I also think there's retreat going on. And there the women are preparing basket staves. They're taking river cane and splitting it and making basket staves. So the conjecture on my part is that it's women doing it. The fact of it is that the basket staves are being made and the fabrics and the string and fiber are being made. So those are two activities that appear in the archaeological record. I mean, there's a lot of medicine being produced. There's over, I think I tallied in an article in American Antiquity, and I don't remember when, 2010 maybe, called Newt Cache, a Women's Retreat Shelter. I think there are 35 species of medicinal plants that are in there. Several of them are abortatives.
Wow.
Several of them are bleeding solutions. Several of them are still associated with women's problems. So there's medicine gathering and processing going on in those rock shelters as well. There is some large mammal. There's some deer bone. There's some rabbit bone and things like that. But they probably, at least in historic times in minstrel retreating, the French recorded that women didn't eat very much in the way of mammalian flesh. But they are, so there's probably a lot of plant material being eaten that's just not showing up. There are some large mammal remains in these sites too. And there, curiously, there are, in several of them, been found bags of the earliest domesticated seeds. An interesting something that I've tried to get some of my ethnobotany people interested in is some of these oldest seeds that have been found in bags in these rock shelters are Chenopodium. And Chenopodium in Mexico is an abortive. You know, and everybody's been writing about, early agriculture, people are eating Chenopodium. I wonder if they are. The roots of Chenopodium are an abortive. The seed is not. But, you know, there's some interesting stuff going on in these rock shelters.
That is very interesting. So I want to be respectful of your time, Dr. Clausen. So I will just ask a few more questions and then we can wrap up and for our interview. So just kind of in conclusion, I'm really interested in what kind of research would you like to see done in this kind of area? I guess we're just talking about it, but when it comes to the archaic and shell middens and sacred landscapes of this time period, what kind of research are you interested in yourself? And what would you like to see other people kind of take up the banner and carry archaeology forward?
I don't know that it's possible to continue doing research on these topics. Most of the museums have repatriated all the collections. They've repatriated the artifact collections and the skeletal collections. I am not allowed to publish photographs that were taken in the excavations in the 1930s and 40s. In some cases, I'm not even allowed to see them. I'm not sure. You know, part of me for the 30 years I've been working on this is like, if I convince everybody these really are burial mounds, nobody will ever be able to do anything ever again with them. So there are other sites that haven't had any excavation done in them. The collections haven't been accumulated. There are ways now that, you know, don't require subsurface collecting. I would love it if some Native American groups in consultation with archaeologists would permit DNA work on the skeletal material if it hasn't all been reburied. Because we can now sex with DNA, we can talk about family relationships between sites, among burial populations. It would be great if new sites could be excavated with modern techniques so that much more attention could be paid to the stratigraphy and to the question of, are these villages? Did it start out as a village and then get repurposed? Was it ever a village? And you would tell that from the variety, the wide variety of artifacts, the large numbers of artifacts, those indicate village. The fact that none of the human bone in report after report after report gnawing is not going on in villages. What villages have dogs? and don't have gnawed bone. So I don't, these dogs aren't running around loose either. But there's lots of little clues that, you know, that somebody who was attuned to all these questions and debates could pay attention to with new excavations. The new excavations in Florida have been fabulous. They've got a good working relationship with the native populations. They're doing DNA work. They're doing all kinds of things that I doubt will ever get done in the mid-continent.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. If University
Is
of
this
Florida,
at the University
Penn Sassaman,
of Florida?
Asa Randall is at the University of Oklahoma. Matt Sanger. Those folks are doing just fabulous excavation work, are totally convinced that those are ceremonial sites that they're looking at.